All right, so this is the third in what will end up being a series of four podcasts on controlled experiments. So again, just to recap really quickly from last time, we are thinking mainly about quantitative experiments and trying to figure out how to analyze these things. Last time I introduced the notion of inferential statistics and described the logic of null hypothesis testing. And today what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a couple of basic inferential statistics tests and describe how they work. In particular, we'll focus on the t-test, and I'll touch on ANOVAs, though I'll save the bulk of that for next time. The other thing I'll touch on today is correlation. So correlation is not necessarily an inferential thing, but nevertheless, this is where I'm going to stick it. Okay, so just to remind us where we were at, we were talking about inspecting data and thinking about data, particularly thinking about it in terms of descriptive statistics. And the problem, of course, is that we always see variation in data that we collect. So let's imagine two different scenarios, one where we do 10 tosses with different but fair dice. We're not always going to get an even distribution of all the possibilities there, right? You're going to get some variation. But on the other hand, if you get 10 tosses, like some samples of 10 tosses with loaded dice, and compare that to some of the fair dice, then you're going to get some variation that is not just sort of normal variation, but actually some of that variation is caused by the fact that some of the dice are loaded. And so what we want with our tests is the ability, with the inferential tests, is the ability to make decisions about whether or not this is sort of normal variation, the kind of stuff that you would expect just from random sampling, or whether this is caused by some other factor. And of course, in experimental situations, we actually control the other factor, right? So we actually typically trying to see whether or not this is having a big impact or not. I want to talk a little bit about the t-test. A t-test is a very standard statistical test that's used to compare the means of two samples, and we use it to help us decide whether they are same or different in the population. So this is one that you're going to see fairly frequently. Null hypothesis of a t-test is just this, that there is no difference between the means of two sets of collected data. So the basic intuition, if you think about this, is that it is more likely that the two samples are coming from different populations if the means are very different and each sample's variances are tight. So let's just bring this back to that running example that we introduced last time. Just to recap from last time, the basic question we were asking was, which interface is best for tapping? And we were comparing a mouse touching the screen and using a stylus to touch on the screen. So a reciprocal tapping task where you alternately tap these buttons 100 times, let's say. And let's say here were the average times. So if these were the average times that it took per click based on each condition, and I told you the variance was very, very small, that is something like, let's say, 0.05 seconds, then you would be fairly confident that something was going on. If, on the other hand, the variance, that is sort of normal, the normal variance that is happening between the samples is, let's say, a second, then you would be less confident that there is actually a difference here, right? That is that the mean is just kind of capturing whatever happened, but the normal variance of actually tapping on these things actually kind of encompasses the other means. And that gives you less confidence that there's actually something going on here. Right? Just as another quick example to help you build some intuition, this is an example that I pulled off of the web, and in the URL, or in the notes section, you can actually see what the URL is. So here, this is a biology example. So here what they did was they actually collected samples from a whole bunch of different birds. So each bird is represented from A to P. And what they did was they compared the yellowness index of a typical feather that you would find off of each bird versus one of the odd feathers that you would get off of that bird. And an odd feather tends to have a different yellowness index. It tends to be slightly discolored because it is typically regrown, perhaps because they lost that feather for some reason. Okay, so on the left table, you can actually see what the yellowness index was for each bird, a typical feather, and then for an odd feather. And then what they've done here is that they've actually graphed this out. So on the top right, you can actually see what the typical feather looked like and then also what the odd feather looked like. next to each other. And then on the next thing, on the next image there, you can actually see what the difference is, kind of all graphed out there too, right? So you can see some, mostly there are positive differences, and there are some small negative differences. Now, what you would say is that, just as an intuition, is that if all of these differences were kind of on the positive side and there were never anything on the negative side, then you'd say that it was more likely, probably, that there's actually a difference here. That is, that these odd feathers really are odd compared to a typical feather, right? If some of the, in one direction, right? I'm not really sure how yellowness index works, but let's say it's more yellow, right? If you saw some that were on the top, like the where the difference was like on the positive side here, and then some of them were on the negative side, and it was just kind of all over the map, then you would have less confidence that there's actually something going on here in a very systematic sort of way. So these two examples I'm just using to try to help you build some of your intuition about how the t-test actually works, right? So if you're comparing means of samples and thinking about variation, right? How much of that variation is just kind of due to sampling, and then how much of that variation is actually due to some difference based on some factor, okay? So when it comes down to it, there's a bunch of different t-tests. Two things that you need to be concerned about are whether it's paired versus unpaired, or one-tailed versus two-tailed. And so I'll just kind of go through this really quickly. Unpaired or independent samples, often called between subjects in HCI, essentially means you have different participants in each group, and each sample from one group is independent from every sample from the other. So, for example, let's suppose in the reciprocal tapping task, I had 10 participants, or I had 20 participants do the mouse condition, and then a separate 20 participants do the touch condition, right? Then you would have completely independent samples, right? None of the participants in the first condition are related to any of the participants in the second condition, okay? This would be considered unpaired or independent samples between subjects. Paired or dependent samples, or kind of an associated term is within subjects, is when each sample from a group is related to a sample in another group. So for instance, imagine that, as in the original description of that running example, you had 10 participants and they did the mouse condition, and then I used the same 10 participants and they also did the touch condition, right? Or 20 participants. In this case, these are paired somehow because they're related to one another, right? That is that each participant who is participating in the first condition is participating in the second condition. Or again, there's some relationship. One of the examples I saw online was paired samples where you'd have in condition one is essentially the husbands and in condition two is the wives. And there's a pairing there, right? So in this case, what actually happens is that the t-test calculates the difference from one group to another and then assesses whether or not these differences actually have are actually different from zero. And that's actually what was happening in that previous example where I was showing you the yellowness index of the birds. Right, so then there's another set of differences that are important, whether you're thinking about a one-tailed t-test or a two-tailed t-test. So if you remember the procedure of the null hypothesis testing, the first step was to articulate a null hypothesis, which is often that there's nothing going on. And then the second is to articulate an alternate hypothesis. And typically what I said was, it's just so there's some difference. Well, a variation on that is to say that your alternate hypothesis is that the difference is in this direction. That is, I believe condition one is going to be higher than condition two or lower than condition two, whatever it is. You pick one, basically. And if you look at these two images here, what ends up happening is that you sort of get more allowance in terms of your p-value if you have a one-tailed t-test. So the way to think about this is that you're using a one-tailed t-test, you're essentially stacking cards in favor of one side of the equation. The problem with this is that, and this is great if you're certain that this is the direction that something is going to happen, the problem is that this fails to recognize the condition where what is actually happening is, or what the data might suggest is that your condition is actually worse than the other. Right? So you're actually discounting the possibility that it's on the other side. So often in HCI work, what we do is we just simplify this for ourselves. You know, we're introducing some new interface condition. We don't know whether it's actually better or worse, right? And so we just go with a non-directional two-tailed test. And so if you think about that mouse versus touching condition, we would probably have done a two-tailed test because we don't actually know which direction the touch would have gone for us. When you're actually doing these calculations, the t-test makes a bunch of assumptions about the data. And I'm not going to get into this too much, but I'll just talk about what these assumptions are. So it assumes that data points for each sample are normally distributed. In practice, it turns out the t-test is pretty robust, but you can use different tests to see whether or not your data points in the samples are normally distributed. A QQ plot is a graphical method of doing this, and it is pretty easy to look at. But again, I'm not going to get into this too much. Please Google it if you're interested. The other thing that it assumes is that population variances are equal. The t-test turns out to be reasonably robust even when the variances are different. And there are also other tests that you can use if it were the case that the population variances were unequal. You can use Levine's test or an F-test to actually test this out. The third assumption is that individual observations of data points in the sample are independent from one another. That is that no sample, no data point has any effect on any other data point. So in practice, what you would do is you would conduct statistical tests for the first two assumptions. If they don't check out, then you use different variations of the t-test. And this stuff you can completely Google, so I'm not going to get into it too much. Two-tailed unpaired t-test. So I'm just going to show you how to walk through one of these calculations, okay? So the main thing that you need to be concerned with is the thing on the right. And so the way that the t-test works is that you calculate a t-statistic for your samples, and then you compare it to a big table. The table that appears here on the next slide is actually a table of what we call critical values. The critical values are constructed based on the number of degrees of freedom and also an alpha value. And so what you use this for is to compare the t-statistic that you get from your previous calculation with basically your degrees of freedom and your alpha, and then you basically compare the t-statistic with the critical value, and that helps you to make your decision. So if you take a look at the t-statistic down at the bottom there, what it's doing is it's essentially calculating the difference between the means of your samples, right? And then on the bottom part of this, it's dividing it essentially by something that's sort of like a variation, and it's biasing the variation based on, or it ends up being sort of standard deviation. And what it's doing is it's biasing it based on how big the sample, how big each of the samples are. So you take your t-statistic and your degrees of freedom, you go to the next slide, and based on your degrees of freedom, you kind of look for the right area on the table, you look for the right line on the table, and then the alpha value that you had chosen, either 0.05 or 0.01, and you basically compare that number in the table with your t-statistic. If your t-statistic is bigger than the number that appears here, then you essentially reject the null hypothesis. And that's it. If your t-statistic is less than the number that you see here, then you cannot reject the null hypothesis. So here's an example that's worked through. And here are the sample data, basically. X1 comprises, you know, for the first sample, right, 3, 4, 4, 4, 5, 5, 5, 6. X2 is the second sample, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, 6, 7, 7. And you try to see whether or not there's a difference, basically. So these are unpaired. And this is just walking through that entire calculation. S squared is an estimate of the population variance. And you just walk through this calculation, right? So you've calculated S2, you calculate the t-statistic, and once you've got the t-statistic, then you basically look it up, the critical value. The critical value is the value that appears in the table, and you make the decision. In this case, because the t-statistic is less than the critical value that is appearing in the table, you don't reject the null hypothesis. There's a mechanism to do this in Excel. So what you do is you add the analysis tool pack, And these are a set of images that show you how to actually go about doing this. And then when you're actually kind of in your data, you can actually select your data and then hit data analysis. And you can see here that it's exposing three different t-tests. And you can actually use Excel to actually conduct this t-test for you. That said, there's the ability to essentially do this stuff manually and be confident in what's going on as well. On slide number 19, you can actually see what the output might look like. And here you can actually see that it gives you a critical value for a one-tailed t-test and also a critical value for a two-tailed t-test. It just depends on which one you were trying to do. And then it also gives you the p-value there too, right? So the p that t is less than or equal to lowercase t, right? And in both of these cases, you can see that, or at least in the case of the two-tailed t-test, this p-value is greater than an alpha value of 0.05, let's say. And in that case, this is not significant. So that's basically it for t-tests. I'm going to include a couple links inside of the PowerPoint deck so that you have some references that you can go to. As I said, there are a bunch of variations on the t-test depending on whether or not those assumptions actually check out. In practice, it's not going to make a huge difference, but these are the right things to do, essentially. So now you have a sense of how the t-tests work. And one of the challenges with the t-test is it only allows you to compare between two different means. There are often cases where you want to compare across three different means, right? So if we think about that running example where we're trying to compare click speed between different input devices, mouse, touch, and stylus, now you have three different means. So how do you go about doing that comparison? It turns out that it's not correct to compare mouse with touch and then touch with stylus and then mouse with stylus and do three different t-tests like that. Instead, you want to use one test that basically compares all three of these means at the same time. So this would be called a single factor analysis of variance. So in this slight variation, I'm just going to say that instead of imagining that you had only 10 participants do all of the different touch tasks, imagine that you had participants 1 through 10 do the mouse task, and then participants 11 through 20 do the touch task, and then participants 21 through 30 do the stylus task. Here you have a single factor, and the factor is basically which input technique. And in that case, what you do is run a single factor analysis. It basically gives you, the result that it gives you is either that these are all the same, the means are all the same, or at least one of these is different from the others. And next time what I'll do is I'll explain this a little bit more and describe what you would do if you had that result. Okay, so let's move on to correlation. So correlation is a technique that you use to measure the extent to which two concepts are related. So some examples, how many years of university training does somebody have versus the number of owners, the number of computers somebody has. Something you might compare is touch versus mouse typing performance. So, you know, if you type really quickly, are you good with the mouse somehow, right? Perhaps with the reciprocal tapping task. So how do you do this? You obtain two sets of measurements, and then you basically calculate a correlation coefficient. What you get on the other side is a number that ranges between -1 and +1, and 1 means that these two numbers are perfectly correlated with one another in a positive way. -1 also means that they're perfectly correlated with one another, but in a negative fashion. And 0 is essentially no correlation. They're completely unrelated to one another. The next slide there, what you see is some data points, and they're just plotted out, condition 1 and condition 2. And the R-squared value, or the correlation coefficient, is 0.668. So in practice, what you would call this is a pretty good correlation. This is pretty high. This is pretty big deal. It depends on which correlation coefficient you're actually calculating, but an easy way to think about this is, you know, 0.0 to 0.3 is probably almost no correlation. 0.3 to 0.5 or 0.6 is a medium level correlation. 0.6 and above is an insanely ridiculous correlation, and it's pretty serious. And I'm talking about absolute values, of course. So if you have -0.668, That's also a pretty serious correlation, but in a negative way. Some other examples of things that you might be calculating correlation coefficient for: age of users versus the average amount of time that they spend in front of a computer, or age of users versus the amount of time they play video games. You might be comparing the amount of time they play video games with their eye-hand coordination, some measure of eye-hand coordination, right? Age of users and a preference of a system. So correlation actually ends up being kind of interesting in a bunch of different ways. Next slide, I'm just showing you here a bunch of different ways you can calculate correlation coefficients. Pearson's, Spearman's rank, Kendall Tau, and these each make different kinds of assumptions about the data. Pearson's product movement coefficient is probably the easiest one to do, and it's a very common one that we see. Spearman's rank makes fewer assumptions about the data, so it doesn't necessarily mean that it means that the data doesn't necessarily need to be interval or ratio. You can actually use this for ordinal data. So, in fact, when you're looking at correlations as they relate to questionnaire data, when people are asking people to rate things between 1 and 7, they should actually be using Spearman's rank correlation coefficient. Kendall Tau rank correlation coefficient is another one that you can use. Just putting the names up here so that when you come back, if you find that you need it one day, you can come back to this and Google them up. Some obvious things to think about when you're working with correlations is that people often attribute causality, but a correlation doesn't necessarily imply cause and effect. And often, we are very conservative about when we report these things, in spite of what the media does with them, because often there might be some third hidden variable or some other set of variables going on that is actually causing the effect in both the variables. So I'll give you an example of this in a moment. The other thing that you sometimes end up with is that you're working with very, very low numbers or very few observations. And in that case, you can't draw strong conclusions from these numbers because it's sort of an unreliable metric. So here's just an example of where it doesn't work too well, right? So imagine that you had people's salaries somehow and you kind of assessed how many pickles they ate each month, okay? It's obvious that in some ways this is completely ridiculous, right? Eating pickles doesn't necessarily cause your salary to increase. And similarly, salary does not necessarily cause you to eat more pickles, right? Even if this correlation were here. So, you know, the search for the causality of this relationship is something that people will try to do, but it's not necessarily something that is a reasonable thing to do. So another possibility here that we're showing on the slide, pickle consumption predicts higher salaries because older people tend to like pickles better than younger people, and older people tend to make more money than younger people. So here the idea is that the theory is that the older you get, the more money you make, and the other thing is the older you get, the more likely you are to like pickles. And here what you see is that there is some third variable that is actually causing this relationship to happen, or maybe is causing this relationship to happen, right? So the problem with correlation is that we don't necessarily have all the factors kind of in mind. Cigarette consumption, here's another just quick example. Again, does correlation necessarily imply causality? We can't always say, right? So here is just how many people died from lung cancer versus the consumption of cigarettes across various countries. And you see that there is a very strong correlation, but you can't necessarily prove that cigarette smoking causes death. Instead, there might be other age, other variables at work here. What is the age what is the population age in each of these countries? Is there a poverty effect going on? Right. So these things are all things that we need to be considerate of when we're thinking about correlation. A related test is regression, and what this one does is it's not so much a test as a technique. And what it does is it calculates a line of best fit in terms of two different variables. So using this line of best fit, we can actually predict essentially what the rating on variable two is going to be based on variable one. Regression is something that you can do with the Excel analysis pack. I believe correlation calculating Pearson moment product Pearson product moment coefficient is something that you can do with the Excel analysis pack as well. All right, so that's it for this podcast. What we talked about mainly was some basic inferential tests, in particular the t-test, and also talked about touched on single factor of analysis of variance, and then also correlation and regression analysis. Thanks.